Today's episode of the Inside EVs podcast is brought to you by E-Range EV Tyre. E-Range EV tyres are specifically engineered for electric vehicles. Using an advanced manufacturing process called liquid phase mixing, E-Range EV's EcoPoint 3 technology creates a tyre with lower rolling resistance and longer range, while offering low levels of wear and high grip. All this while staying affordable. Go to erangetyres.com. That's E-R-A-N-G-E tyres.com to find your EV's next set of tyres.
Hello and welcome to the Inside EVs podcast for October the 28th, 2022. This is episode number 134. Today's episode is brought to you by E-Range EV Tyres. And on today's show, we'll be talking about the Lotus Eletre details that have just been made known, the debut of the Toyota bZ3 in China, and GM's production plan is seeing a six-month delay. I'm Dominic Yoni, Inside EV's forum moderator and Inside EV's editor. Joining us today is the nonchalant Tom Malogny, Inside EV's editor and host of the YouTube channel State of Charge. We also have the macrobiotic munching Mr. Martin Lee from the EV News Daily podcast, which is available on all the best podcast platforms. And of course, Kyle Connor joins us from the majestic, practically palatial halls of Autospec Studios, where he produces high voltage videos for a growing number of YouTube channels. So welcome, everybody. Good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Morning. All right.
So let's kick this off with some news and get to what we've been driving this week and visits across the country we've been making. All right. So the Lotus Eletre made its debut last March 31st. And it is expected to start shipping next year. And now the automaker has released details about its European and UK pricing and specifications. So basically, the Eletre comes in three trims, just plain Eletre, Eletre S, and Eletre R. So interestingly, the two lower trims are rear-wheel drive, while the Eletre R is a dual-motor all-wheel drive. The Eletre and Eletre S put out 603 horsepower and 523 foot-pound of torque, and can supposedly hit 62 miles an hour or 100 kilometers an hour in 4.5 seconds. The all-wheel drive R puts out 905 horsepower and 726 pound-feet of torque, and is claimed to do a 2.9 second 0 to 60. All the trims feature a 112 kilowatt-hour battery on an 800-volt system, and Lotus says it will charge 10 to 80% in 20 minutes, which is, you know, pretty good. Range for the rear-wheel drive trims is 373 miles WLTP and 304 miles for the dual motor R. Prices start at £89,500 in the UK and €95,990 in Germany for the base model. The Lotus Eletre S adds a bunch of features and starts at £804,500 in the UK and €120,990 in Germany. So the Eletre R gets a bunch of performance options, including a handling pack, a brake pack, high-performance tires. It's got a track mode for £120,000 in the UK and €150,990 in Germany. So, Martin, So I don't expect that you plunk down £5,000 to reserve one of these for yourself, but now that we know the pricing and some more details, do you think there's like a potential for the Eletre to do for Lotus what the Cayenne did for Porsche?
It's difficult because of the Porsche brand being so much stronger globally, and Lotus coming from behind, obviously with a very, very, you know, storied history in motorsport and lots to draw on if you know the Lotus story. But if you don't know the Lotus story, then perhaps it's, in many people's eyes, a niche car maker from a shed in East Anglia, which is a cruel of me. But the Hethel facility is, you know, is amazing. It's really good, obviously, with the big ownership now behind it. And making some really, really interesting vehicles. They can put a price on this of whatever they want, because I think if you want one, you're going to buy one. And if you don't, you won't, which kind of sounds really obvious. Sorry about that. But it's one of those ones where the price doesn't really matter, as long as it's not 200 grand or something silly. They need to reinvent themselves with a view on just selling more vehicles. Or what's the point of them being around? You either go very small, niche, handmade, you know, everyone being bespoke and different, or you try and go more mainstream and sell more versions. This is their attempt at it. Will it work? Well, time will obviously will tell. I think the pricing is about spot on. I think the styling looks amazing. And of course, if they want to draw on all of that motorsport history that they've got, they absolutely can do. And the important thing is, I think for Lotus, as a Brit, very proud of the cars being made here, they just need to tell that story of why Lotus is special and why you should choose this over and above, you know, one of the German brands that you know, a Porsche, like you say.
Right. Or a Lamborghini Urus, even. Actually, when I see this, I see, like, a Lamborghini Urus, and, like, so I'm thinking, you know, is it like a direct replacement? Kyle, what do you think about that?
Well, it's so much less expensive than an Urus, so
yeah, right.
And not even in, I don't know, that's just totally different. You buy an Urus because you want big, loud crackling pops out the exhaust and
right.
all the noise, and I love every bit of that as well. Personally, I'd go for Cayenne Turbo on the same platform, but different podcast for a different day. I think this thing, yeah, like Martin said, time will tell. For me, it's not pulling at my heartstrings because it's not what I know and love about Lotus. And it sounds like all the Porsche owners back when Cayenne was coming out complaining they're ruining the brand. But guess what? The Cayenne has allowed 911 to stay around. It's allowed for really cool versions of Cayman and Boxster, all the fun cars that we love. And so maybe this will allow for more lightweight sports cars to come from Lotus down the line. If it doesn't, if this vehicle does not allow Lotus to dig into its heritage and electrify, you know, lightweight-ish, you know, sort of balanced handling vehicles, then I would say this would be a bit of a failure. But if they're like, hey, because we sold so many Electras, we're ready to rock and roll with like an Elise Electric and all the fun stuff, because I've still never driven a really fun, tossable, lightweight EV, this could be the, you know, the real gateway to that.
I was looking at this last night and I realized, you know, I was even wondering what kind of like dealership network they have, because they're not, like you said, they're not like, or like Martin was saying, they're not like quite as storied as a Porsche. Even in the you know, up before the Cayenne, you know, Porsche had like a, you know, pretty dominant kind of space in the automotive firmament. You know, it was definitely a, you know, a highly valued and the sought after brand, and the Cayenne just, you know, cashed in on that. So I'm not sure personally if like Electra can quite do that, to answer my own question.
They have a pretty good sales network in major metropolitan areas. There's a Lotus dealer pretty much in all of them. I'm thinking like Greensboro, North Carolina has a Lotus dealer, and that's not that big of a town. So
right.
I think they'll be okay. Again, you'll have the Lotus loyalists that will be split. Half of them will get this as a daily driver for their existing Lotus. Half of them will say, I will never go near that. This ruins the brand. But at the end of the day, those that do want to go for it will drive to go to their dealer. They don't need one right down the street from where they live. Part of owning a Lotus is a bit of compromise. This will lead it into the mainstream era, hopefully, especially under Geely's ownership. And isn't this the same platform that the Polestar 3 is based on?
I believe I saw somebody mention that like in a comment somewhere, but I'm not sure that it is exactly. I mean, Polestar 3 is 800 volt too, right?
No, I don't believe it is.
Oh, then I don't think it is. I'm not sure if this is. I need to look it up. But I kind of think this is like specific to Lotus. I don't even think it's on the C, because Geely parent company has a C platform. I forget what it stands for, but it's SEA. And I'm not sure. I don't think this sits on that. I'd have to look that up.
Electric premium architecture.
Electric. Oh, thank
this
you.
One. EPA. Brilliant.
EVA. Okay.
EPA.
EPA. Right. John in the comments is asking what the price is on the Lotus. Well, the top racy one is 150,000 euros, and the base one is 89,500 euros. So up from a BMW iX, this is more like what, probably Lucid territory, but it's a different kind of a crossover than Lucid. Just getting back to the store. So they have 43, I think around 43 stores now. And I think they want to have like 50 stores in by the time this comes out. Oh, I mean, 2025, I think, for the Emira, which is still like a gas car. So they're still making some gas cars, I believe, recently.
Well, honestly, let's hope they never stop, because that's the benefit of Lotus, is this electric vehicle will allow them to produce some of the best combustion sports cars for the weekends,
right?
Which is what we all want to drive Saturday and Sunday. At least me and my friends, we don't want to be driving this at the track on Saturday and Sunday.
Nope. Mm. They do have some tie-in with the actual Nürburgring, this car. I think eventually it's going to be supposed to be able to drive itself around the Nürburgring, which is kind of odd, because I look at it, I see it sporty, but I don't know if it's like racy, like, you know.
No, like that's dumb.
Yeah, like I don't know, and I don't know why you'd want the car to drive you around the racetrack. And this is like in the Rimac Navarro, where it kind of takes you around to show you, to teach you how the, you know, to drive the track, but I don't think that's what this is doing. So we don't need to spend a whole lot of time on this, but Tom, did you want to throw down on this before we move on?
Not really. You guys, I think, nailed mostly everything. I'm surprised. I know Martin pulled up the comment that Adam made. I'm surprised nobody else commented on it. Geez, this thing looks like a Kia EV6 GT with like Boy Racer sport panels put on top of it to me. The side profile, it really looks like an EV6. It looks like that's where the designer started and then just like built it out and tried to make it look a little bit more outrageous. I love the interior. I think that looks really cool. Yeah. Let's see how it performs. They have to move in this direction, Lotus. They have to put something out. I think Kyle was talking about how they need a vehicle that will sell so that they can have fun making other stuff. And, right. You know, maybe this will be that vehicle. Maybe it'll do for them, you know, what other automakers have seen with like these mid-sized crossovers, how that seems to be what everybody wants these days. And, you know, this probably is the best type of a vehicle for Lotus to put out at this point, electric. Just hopefully their loyalists embrace it and buy some of them.
Right. I think it's coming to the U.S. in 2024. I wasn't sure actually if it was even coming. I had to look in. I see some dealerships in the States like advertising and taking reservations. It's like a $5,000 reservation to put down. But
yeah, the European Union passed the 2035 regulations yesterday and there are some concessions made, by the way, but very, very fierce lobbying from the car makers and all of the CEOs saying, look, just do not put a 2035 deadline on zero emissions. And there were concessions, but that went through yesterday, which is huge, huge news, by the way, because that's not long in car world. But there are some exemptions for small car makers. And so I don't know if Ferrari is classed as a small car maker or Lamborghini or Lotus. But yeah, if you sell a certain amount of or below a threshold, then you're not required to meet the zero emission of your fleet of cars, and so you can carry on, which makes a lot of sense, because if they sell 5,000 or 10,000 of whatever emitting vehicles, if we do 99% of vehicles zero emissions, that gets us there, right? And then if somebody wants a weekend toy, like people still ride horses, you know, just not to commute to work, then there's nothing wrong with that. So maybe even Lotus would be exempted from that, which means they can make interesting electric things and interesting little two-seat sports car, stick a motorbike engine in the back and go on a track day. They should be allowed to do things like that. Let's not be too ideological about these things. So I think they probably would be exempted. I don't know what the threshold... I know that threshold was being negotiated about which companies would have to sell completely zero-emission vehicles. But yeah, I'll try and find out for next week.
All right. So you're getting a little visit from Ellie there, Kyle?
Yes, Ellie came up to watch the show with me.
Here, hey, puppies. Awesome. All right. So the second Toyota BZ model debuted this week in China. This one is just for the Chinese market, and it's built by FAW Toyota, which Toyota's partner in China. BYD is also a partner in this project. So the BZ3 is a sedan, good, they say, for 372 miles of range on the CLTC cycle. I'm not sure what that would translate into EPA. In my head, I just put 300 miles, but we don't know the size of the battery, but we do know that it's an LFP BYD blade pack. Toyota says the battery was newly designed for the BZ3 and should lose only 10% capacity over 10 years. But it's not all BYD inside. We're told that it uses Toyota's extensive electrification technologies, although it doesn't say whether that's hardware, software, or both. Like the BZ4, BZ3 is built on the ETNGA platform. And according to Reuters, it should start shipping before the end of the year and have a base price of around the equivalent of $28,000. So, Tom, you know the Chinese market probably more than most. Are you optimistic, pessimistic, or neutral about the BZ3's chances there? I'm not up to speed really on the on Toyota's popularity there, but it does seem like a pretty decent value at first blush. I don't know.
Yeah, no, Toyota's very popular in China. I saw them all over the place. And it has very good reputation for quality. Okay. And this seems to be a legit competitor in that space. Model 3, you know, XPeng P7, you know, right in that wheelhouse. And yeah, I think this will do pretty well there.
Okay.
I see. It looks way better than the BZ4X because of all that black plastic trim nonsense around the wheel arches on the 4. Whereas the 3, it's a, you know, I think the front is interesting and the styling looks a bit like the new MG4. From other angles, it's a bit of a, you know, bland box, but the front end looks pretty cool. And I think they've got the design of it just about right as well, probably for China. And it depends on the connectivity because, as you know, as we know, the Chinese market, particularly the younger Chinese market, want highly connected, high-tech cars. So this is where VW and the likes are failing because they want it to integrate into their apps, their life, their voice commands. They want to kick back and to have it to become a cinema. And if Toyota get that bit right, they'll do well with the younger audience in China. They can't just sweep in and say, well, hey, we're Toyota. Here's our electric car. You expect to buy it because that's not, you know, as the younger buyers are embracing vehicles like Tesla with its driver assistance systems and that kind of high-tech nature. If they can nail that side of it, they'll do really well in China. If they just behave a little bit like some of the big OEMs have done and wheel out their EVs that aren't that connected and aren't that high tech, then they're going to lose out to the domestic brands, which are doing really, really well.
Yeah, and there's still a lot that we don't know about the vehicle, you know, and how well it charges, for instance, is going to be really important. Most people in China don't live in private residences. Many people don't have the ability to charge at home. It's one of the reasons why NIO has done well there with their battery swap system. And there is the DC fast networks, the whole infrastructure is being built out really, really quickly there, faster than what we're seeing, you know, here and in Europe. So that's helpful. But if the thing takes an hour to get to 80%, then that's not going to play well. So that's, We need to find out how well this thing charges, because most people that buy it are going to rely on public charging. So, you know, that's an important factor that is a little bit different there than it is over here and in Europe.
I think it might do pretty good. The BYD seal is also made by, you know, BYD. It has the similar kind of battery, you know, chemistry and everything, and it charges in about 25 minutes to. Yeah, DC charge time, 25 minutes. I assume that's like the 80% from 10% or something. So, which isn't terrible. So, yeah. But that's not even, it's a car for China, so we don't really get to see this. But they did actually this week. And it's pretty nice. So we'll have to see how it turns out. But for our market, we did see also a different BZ vehicle this week. A hatchback or liftback, if you prefer. We don't really have any info on it, but just Toyota shared this picture. It doesn't seem to be a hatch version of the BZ3. It's got you can see a picture of it here on your screens now. You see that it's got like a sharp crease coming from the top of that front wheel well. That is not on the BZ3. It's more rounded there on that car. So this is like a different car that we haven't seen before. And I thought we'd just share that really quickly. Martin, and I didn't put this in the show notes or anything, but Toyota is like rethinking its electrification or reviewing its electrification strategy this week, right?
It was a single report. It was a Reuters report from, but that claimed they had four sources from within inside the company. So it's Reuters, unnamed sources, but so you would think that there's a fair story behind it. And these sources saying that now high-level management are looking at the likes of Tesla that float around 30% margin on their automotive business and realizing that they are being left behind in the march to electrification in terms of things like production and margins and having to rethink about their electric plans, which of course is good news because we want a strong Toyota making great electric cars. But the surprising thing was is that it claimed, I forget the name of the chap kind of leading their electrification push, thinks that the best way to do that is to press pause on their plan of 30 EVs and to perhaps start again. So they've got their ET and GA platform, which is a platform designed to roll down the same production lines as their combustion vehicles. And Toyota thought, well, over the next 15 years, as we start to ramp up EVs and ramp down combustion, that is that, like the BMW way a few years ago. And the Reuters report saying, actually, Toyota are thinking we may have been wrong on EVs, but we might need to press pause for a couple of years, maybe even redesign a whole new platform, which is a four-year plan, and go hell for leather on a pure EV platform,
right?
Which, you know, what are we, 3 years into this podcast almost? We could have told them that on show one. But welcome to the party, Toyota.
Right. I mean, the shared platform is like, but I mean, that's like this, like the approach of Volkswagen and to some extent GM is taking. I know there's some others.
But what's interesting is it's almost the exact opposite of what BMW did. BMW was all in on BEVs back in 2009, 2010, 2011. They had, you know, four or five different BEV varieties, from the i3 to an i4 to an i5. And they were going all electric. They had carbon fiber frames built out. I mean, you know, we called the BMW, the i3 was codenamed the Mega City vehicle. They had an intra-city vehicle, a couple of names, I forget the names now, but they had platforms for a car that was actually smaller than the i3, and then they had one that was bigger than the i3 that was, you know, made to go longer distances. And you know, they after a few years of that, they pressed the pause button, like seems like Toyota's, and saying, well, maybe electrification isn't going to come as fast as we thought it would. Let's do a whole life cycle of plug-in hybrids and then go full in on EV around 2022, 2023, which is what we're seeing now with i4, iX, and every year i7. Now, every year, there's going to be more and more fully electric vehicles. It seems like Toyota's doing the opposite now. And, you know, their plan was, we're doing the plug-in hybrids for quite some time because full BEV is way out there. You know, we'll sprinkle in a couple full BEVs every now and then, but we're going to leverage plug-in hybrids because we're all about hybrids. And now they're saying, maybe not, you know, maybe the hybrids aren't going to work. So let's press pause, think this thing over, and then go full on in EV. So that's interesting that, you know, these big companies that have so much millions in market research and focus groups and all this stuff, they still don't know what the hell they're doing. You know, all of them, you know, just trying to figure this out. And, you know, they're flip-flopping from plan to plan. And, you know, it's easy, like Martin said, though, we could have just told you that, you know, so, but, hey, it looks like this might be the first hint, first little crumb of evidence that we've gotten that Toyota's finally starting to get it.
Right.
And they have to pay attention to the market, because this week there was a story that Hyundai had pulled out of their landmark Swiss project with green hydrogen, which they quickly denied that they were pulling out of it. And they simply said, well, we're just having problems acquiring the green hydrogen because that's made from renewables. So unless you want to burn fossil fuels to make hydrogen, which was a trucking, they didn't, I think, clarify if they were going to carry on delivering. There's like 46 trucks they're going to deliver to that project in Switzerland. But they went, oh, no, we're not ending it. We're just pressing pause. At Shell in here, Shell have closed down their filling stations because no one was using them. And I believe some of that was even paid for by the government, by the Office of Low Emission Vehicles, or I think a couple of million was put in. So I'm not even sure that, I think it was Shell, run by a company called Motive, I think. I don't want to say this is fact. I think they didn't spend all their own money. I think there was some grant money in there as well to build out these. And they said, well, no one's using them. Like, they're too small to be developed into commercial trucking.
Right.
and yet they're kind of in this middle phase. So they've closed them down. And so it's this ideological hydrogen argument that the Japanese have been making for such a long time, and they're convinced it's coming. And I'm convinced it's coming if we can make it with excess renewables. Let's not burn fossils to make it. I think it's a great way of storing energy for commercial, for aviation, for trains, for possibly for shipping. It doesn't work for personal transport in the slightest, and they're going to have to try and back away from that argument without losing face. And that will be the next verbal gymnastics they have to do. But they're spending a lot of money, and they're still convinced that hydrogen is the future, which they're just electric cars at the end of the day. They just store energy differently. But I don't fancy queuing up at my local hydrogen station to fill up in 10 years. Thanks.
Yeah.
Well, I'm still waiting for Toyota to deliver the 12 hydrogen stations
in
New York and New Jersey and Connecticut area that they promised me they were going to install 10 years ago when they introduced the Mirai. You know, they had dots in the map and everything. You'll be able to drive from here to here. And, they might have broke ground on one, but I don't know if it ever got finished. So and that was like 10 years ago, and they were going to have them all in by within 2 years. So
excess renewables, isn't Europe mostly out of electricity? LOL, Mark Richards adds.
Yes. Yeah, we've got energy crisis. We have Russian pipelines of gas being shut down. We have, over the last few years, this country shut down all of our gas storage because we were like, well, we're interconnected to Europe, so why do we need gas storage? And then there was, a war in Ukraine. We left the EU, and now we're like, can someone help us out, please? So, yeah, there's a huge energy crisis over here. There could be serious, if it ever gets cold. It's boiling here today at the end of October. But if it ever gets
thankfully
cold,
thankfully, too.
Yeah, there could be some real issues. And so, excess renewables? Nah, there's none of those flying around at the minute. You know, and it's electricity is very, very expensive to charge our cars with at the minute. So it's a bit of a mess.
Indeed. So let's talk some Hyundai. The IONIQ 6 first edition details are out. Apparently, there will be only 2,500 copies of the first edition for Germany, the UK, France, Norway, and the Netherlands. Prices start in the UK at £54,995, or about $63,700 US. Like many launch edition, this one comes with exclusive trim bits and colors. It also, and I believe this is maybe my favorite part, comes with tartan inserts on the seats. They're a gray tartan, so it's kind of subtle, but it's still nice. To get one of these coveted first editions, customers are asked to register for the launch event on Hyundai's website in order to pre-order one of the 2,500 available vehicles. Then the online exclusive event takes place on November the 9th at 10 a.m. Central European time. So that's coming up if you want the IONIQ 6. There's some hoops to jump through, I guess. And so have you heard about this, Martin?
I mean, it's gonna they will sell out, won't they? But I remain to be convinced. I think this is a car that looks better in person than photographs, and there are some cars it happens occasionally. There are some cars that just look better when you see them. The proportions just look right, and they just photograph terribly. And the back end of the IONIQ 6 photographs, I think, awfully.
Mercure, maybe?
It looks so bad. Oh, man,
it wishes, Mercure. I think Infiniti J30, I think, is still there. Hey, Kyle, didn't you see one of these at a charging station this week?
Well, I've seen a few of them over the last few months. Got to see them in Germany during the last visit and play around a little bit close to them, and even then I was like, oh, that's pretty ugly in person. But then I saw one, Roush is an engineering company that a lot of EV makers are using them to do mileage accumulation. There's a whole bunch of other companies, but basically they keep a fleet of cars in different areas of the country and they just put miles on them and see if the conditions affect the cars or things like this. So I ran into the Las Vegas Roush's office, their IONIQ 6, which was a fully spec'd one. And I was talking to the driver of the car, and of course he couldn't tell me all the details, but I was like looking at a charging station covered in bugs, and I was like, wow, that looks pretty good. So yeah, actually, I think I'm coming around to it.
Okay. It's like the EV6. When I first saw the EV6, I did not like it. But then, like this weekend, I saw one up in Valdosta, Georgia, and it's like, that looks. I mean, I could only see it from the front, but even the back, I kind of, you know, it grabs your attention, and I think it does everything it needs to do. I need to see one of these things in person. Personally, I like it more than I did than when I first saw it. Like the new design, I don't know. Anyway, I thought we'd bring that up.
Well, I did get an idea of how it charges because I was there during the charging session. Sure. It seems pretty much just like Ioniq 5, no surprise.
Right. Yeah, we kind of expect it, except it has like a lot more range because it's not an SUV.
Yep.
And I think they have talked about, they've actually made some improvements. So it's not, they haven't just taken the Ioniq 5 Kia EV6 and put it underneath this. There are some structural improvements they've made to things like thermal management and some serious bits as well that aren't the work of the moment. So I think that's also why it does better.
I like that interior though. It's nice, yeah, clean. It looks
cool. And I don't love the interior, and it's weird. I don't hate the exterior, so I'm going to be the contrarian here.
Okay. I'm not sure about the tartan.
There's your gray tartan seats. Subtle, yes, but
not so sure.
I like them. While we're on the topic of Hyundai, make sure I'm saying that right.
No, you're still not saying it right. How do you say Monday or Sunday?
Sunday.
Yeah, there you go. You just put an H in front of it.
Hyundai. But I want to throw a little Y in there. Hyundai.
No.
Okay.
Not how they say it.
Sometimes I hear like the Y. I believe I hear the Y in it when they say it sometimes. I mean, not all the time.
Don't believe everything you hear, Dom.
Yeah, it's Dom's impression of Hyundai. You can say it however you like.
Did you say I'm impressionable?
Yeah, but like I wouldn't say it however you like and then say I'm saying it correctly. But
right. Yeah, no, I don't. I would never say that I'm saying it correctly because So, but while we're on the topic of Hyundai, it just broke ground on a big new plant in South Carolina. They announced originally back in May. So it will only make electric cars and support about six different models for Hyundai, Kia, and Genesis. And yeah, I just thought I'd mention that was a groundbreaking this week. So it's kind of a big deal. South Carolina, yeah, it's kind of really South Carolina is getting a lot of battery plants and manufacturing plants of this whole electrification thing. There's really some big winners in the southern states. Like we haven't really talked about that much, but like Tennessee and South Carolina, they're making it like bandits practically. Even Georgia's got lots of, you know, battery plants and car factories going up. It's pretty neat.
And they're all good jobs. They're one of the U.S. outlets had a look at red states, blue states, and where all the EV factories are going up. And it was really interesting how so many of the Republicans talk down, you know, anything that might offend voters. But actually, when you look at where money's being spent, where incentives are being channeled, and so many really good future well-paying jobs in the electric industry are going in red states. So that's, look, wherever they go, it's great news. Interesting.
The thing about that, many of the redder states are rural and have lots of land and are less expensive. The lands, a lot of the bluer states seem to be clustered in, not all of them, but many of them on the coasts where real estate's really expensive. And, you know, you need enormous sprawling, you know, facilities to build factories like this, you know, many, many, many acres. And it's just more economically viable to find them in areas that are more rural.
Right. And those states also have laws regarding unions that are less favorable to forming unions. So it's manufacturers tend to like not have to deal with unions.
Yeah. Yeah. And Greg just posted a good thing, you know, cheaper labor in red states, more poor people. It's sad, but it's true in many instances.
Right. Right. But I like the idea personally because it brings around, you know, it helps take politics out of the equation a little bit because, you know, where politics gets into everything way too much. And it'd be nice to keep some things somewhat apolitical, somewhat. But anyway, we can move on.
Well, we've talked about that forever. And I'm just going to add one last comment. It's driven me nuts that electric cars are a political football because it's that you can't make a solid argument against them. It's, you know, there's the startups have been American car companies, Rivian, Tesla being the biggest one, employing Americans, building vehicles here. The energy used to fuel them is domestic, 100% domestic energy. We don't import electricity, and it goes to employ people to, you know, install new infrastructure. You know, besides building the vehicles, building out a whole new infrastructure in this country, you know, would create thousands more jobs. And, you know, it's just so crazy that, you know, that has become a football. And it shouldn't be, because nobody should be against it. You shouldn't be forced to buy an EV if you don't want one, but nobody should be against us building and making and using EVs in this country. Yet, you know, it seems like there's a large percentage of the country that is. End rant.
All right. So let's move on a little bit. So GM's electrification plans have hit a bit of a snag. It had said it would deliver 400,000 EVs by the end of 2023. And I believe that's cumulative. So apparently it's had some trouble finding and training like 1,000 workers for its battery plant in Warren, Ohio. That's just by Lordstown, along with issues in pack assembly as well. I don't think they make their own. I think Magna's making their packs. So now it says that it will only hit 400,000 vehicles halfway through 2024. So, Kyle, there's a lot of chatter out there about this, but do you think it's a really much consequence, 6 months?
You know, I haven't really dug into the exact numbers to know how much of a consequence it is. Certainly, it's not welcome and good news. You know, and coming right off of the Chevy Bolt issues, this is not what anyone wants to hear. I've been to the Hummer EV battery assembly plant and actually filmed a video there. It hasn't gone live yet, but it was a really interesting plant. I don't know what part of the battery pack is failing specifically. Oh. So, you know, maybe you do, but I haven't dug into the story myself. So tell us what exactly is going on
with the Hummer.
The Hummer has a battery, has a recall this week, I believe. I think it's electroplating on the two panels where it comes together. This electroplating wasn't done properly in spots or something. So the adhesive isn't sticking. It isn't forming a true good bond when they put the panels together. So is the potential for leaking for water ingress?
Yeah, and some of the BrightDrop vans are being recalled as well.
Same battery.
I think they called it a flange leakage, which nobody wants. It just sounds like a very painful thing for someone to suffer from. They weren't clear whether it was a design issue that's now been redesigned or whether it was a production issue. It was in the casing. It's not the battery, it's the casing, but it ultimately leads. It happened to two customer vehicles, which wouldn't start. It happened to one of their Hummers on their proving ground, which stopped whilst they were driving it. And in all cases, water ingress. And, you know, water in the battery is less good news. That 735 odd Hummers being recalled, which sounds like all of them to me.
It's not all of them. But
all right, okay.
But it's a good number. I know of multiple Hummers, one of them being TFLs, that have stopped working due to software. Wow. And I know of at least two that basically just gave up. And so to me, seems like maybe software is not doing so hot here.
Yeah. And I had one last week. I actually got the first loan of the Hummer that was here on the East Coast. GM sent one to the press fleet here, and I was the first one to get it. And now that's the recall, they might be holding it. Usually they do that when the vehicles are under recall, at least if this specific one is, nobody else is getting it. So I had it all week last week. I drove it about 1,400 miles in the week because I wanted to do charge recordings. You guys remember, I talked about that I did charge recordings out in Detroit when I did the range test, and I couldn't get it to continue to charge. It kept shutting off. It kept derating. And so I got one now and drove it like crazy, like 1,400 miles in 7 days. So I was able to do four charging sessions on it because I had to charge it to 100%, then drive it down to zero. The damn thing goes 350 miles. So it was painful. I was just driving it out to from New Jersey out to Pennsylvania to nowhere so I can go fast and turn around and come back. So I actually stopped at the new Electrify America, the new charging station down in King of Prussia that has the new Balance chargers. I did some recordings there. Kyle just posted. He ran a comment. He was with his ID4 at King of Prussia when I was there. I actually met a few people there that recognized me from my channel and also from the podcast, which was pretty cool. And I was talking to everybody. But the long story I'll make short is I still experienced a lot of problems charging. And this is a different vehicle charging on three different charging stations. It will plug it in, boom, pulls crazy amount of power. 367 is the most I saw right there. Other times it didn't pull quite as high. It pulled like 350 or 355. It'll do that for about 4 minutes. And then it drops down to 3 kilowatts.
What?
And holds that for like a couple of minutes. Then it goes up to 88 kilowatt and holds that for like 40 minutes. So then, So I was able to charge it at a different station up here in New Jersey where it peaked at like 280 and it held that for like 10 minutes. And then it dropped down to like 180 for a little while, then 160 for a little while. I think that's more of what we should expect from it. But the charging sessions I have are all over the place. There's no consistent charging on it. And I tried doing it with preconditioning and without. To be honest with you, I'm going to recommend to any of the followers out there have the Hummer EV. Do not set preconditioning. It gets to the station too hot. Do it maybe if it's really cold outside. But in normal temperature, like it is now, it's not too cold yet. You don't need the preconditioning. It actually gets it too warm because then when you plug in, it derates after like 2 minutes. So it's GM, I think, still has some work to do with the software on the charging. And I'm going to have a video out soon, but I'm sending all my recordings to GM and I'm going to ask for comment on it. And I'm going to say, what was going on here? Why did it drop down here? Why did it hold 88 kilowatt for 40 minutes? You know, why didn't it, right. it go back up after that? And I'm going to see what they say. Hopefully they'll give me an answer because I do want to get a response from them before I come out with this video because it's not going to be complimentary on Hummer EV charging. And I want to have them at least give them the opportunity to explain what was going on. Now, this is two different vehicles charged at four different charging stations and getting crazy erratic charging every time.
So our friend Nebula passed me a link, which I sent to you for a Hummer forum and stuff where people were talking about the charge. Did you have a chance to see that at all?
I didn't. Dom, I've been traveling all week.
Sure. Yeah,
and I just haven't had time to. And we'll talk about what I was traveling about later in the news. Yeah. I actually haven't. So I'm putting together because I want to send GM not only the videos, but my charging curves plotted out on paper so they can look at it and say, you know, hey, what happened right here? Why did it do that? And hopefully they'll give me an answer.
Right. News Column says, so far, the Hummer owners I've seen are super happy, satisfied with their charging, which, it's...
And I've heard that too. But what I'll say is there's a difference between somebody going to a DC fast charge station and plugging in at 20 or 30% and walking away for 40 minutes and coming back and seeing that it's at X amount of power, as opposed to standing there and studying it and watching it go up and down. Yeah. I honestly think most people don't pay attention to that stuff. And you know, and they come back and they're like, oh, great, I went from 10% to 60% in 20 minutes, and they don't realize that the thing was going nuts the whole time. Now, I'm not painting everybody with a broad brush, but I think majority of people are in that category. So, you know, it's still, charges relatively quickly. You know, I mean, it was less than an hour to get to 80% for such a huge battery.
That's
you know,
crazy.
But when you look at it on paper, it's like, why the hell is it doing this? It makes no sense. So, you know, it could be switching between packs. You know, they have the two packs that, you know, together, you know, can accept the 800 volts. But that's great. But it's wacky. When you see it on paper, it seems like it doesn't make sense why it's doing that. And why, after it derates, why does it go up to 88 kilowatt and hold that? Like, you're telling me it can't charge at higher than 88 kilowatts at 20% state of charge?
That's strange.
It is strange.
And we always talk about the 200 kilowatt hour pack in the Hummer, but that's not true, is it? It's much bigger. What was it that you measured?
I think the total capacity is 246.
Right.
The usable's 212 or 236. I know on my 0 to 100% charge recording that I did get one off. I think it took in like 246 kilowatt hours, something like that. It's crazy.
That's weird. Interesting.
Or like full regular.
It sounds like there's still a lot to learn about the Hummer EV. It's like, it's got some secrets.
Yeah.
All right. It's just a couple of really quick things, items before we get to what we've been driving. But so the Ford F-150 Lightning with the big battery does 0 to 60 in under 4 seconds now. I'm not sure if that's always been that way, if they made some like little change. No, it's an improvement over what they had targeted, but I'm not sure if they actually did any software updates. Did you get a software update, Tom?
Software update. I think Farley just like didn't communicate this properly. Was basically saying it's always been that quick. We've just now decided to tell you that.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
So. So F-150 Lightning's owners, your truck is pretty quick, quicker than it needs to be even.
Yeah, it hauls. The funny thing is, I have a Rivian also now, and I had the Hummer all week. So my driveway had the three, you know, trucks, and the Lightning is the slowest of all three. And that's just stupid because it's so fast. You know, it's crazy that it's the slowest one out of the three.
You had an epic driveway. And speaking of Rivian, so their latest OTA software update adds Neil mode to R1S and R1T, which I thought was pretty neat. But Kyle, you mentioned this on Twitter the other day. You're not sold on this Neil mode.
Well, I think anytime you need to constantly adjust air suspension, it adds stress to the system. It's a point of failure. The compressor has to kick on every time. Right. I've been driving R1S for the past few days, and I haven't done it on my personal truck, but I've been using it on R1S, and every time it kneels and then needs to stand back up, the air compressor is running. So now it's cycling at least, you know, 10 times more than it would have before. And one thing I typically don't like is when you're in park, one thing I typically don't like is, sorry, buddy, you're being good. There's another, his arch nemesis is walking by the house right now. So it's a real, real time. He's trying to be really good. I don't like when the suspension binds up, raising and lowering. And one thing I've found though, is at least in auto kneel mode, it's not as bad as you're doing it if you're in auto hold, because it's just the rear calipers that are locked. So the front wheels have a chance to rotate a little bit and change their position as the kinematics change on the suspension. But personally, I'm not turning it on my truck. So just a little bit unnecessary up and down. It's not a unique feature. Range Rovers have been doing this forever. Other vehicles have as well.
Sure.
Not particularly useful for me as a tall person.
Right.
So let me chime in on it. My truck's actually doing the software update right now. I turned it on right before the podcast started. They say it's going to take 80 minutes. I don't know.
It takes every bit of that.
Yeah. So it's actually doing it right now, but I'm looking forward to trying it out. I'll tell you a couple of reasons why. First of all, when I take my in-laws and my parents, they have for a ride, they have trouble getting in and out of the Rivian. Although when I had it at the lowest setting, they were able to do it. But I had to, you know, lower it down to the lowest setting. The Lightning, they prefer driving in because it has a running board and they can step in that and climb in and out. The Rivian doesn't have a running board, doesn't offer a running board. Said there will be no aftermarket running boards because there's no way to attach it because of the way the battery is underneath. So I'm looking forward to trying that out. I mentioned on the podcast a couple of times now, one of the things I'm doing is I have a bunch of people around here that I know that are real pickup truck owners. I've owned multiple pickup trucks. I'm loaning each one of them my Rivian for 2 days and then my Lightning for 2 days. And then I'm recording their response. It's going to take a while because I want to get a bunch of people to do this. Funny, these people I like barely know. I'm like, hey, do you want to drive my $80,000 truck for 2 days? and they're like, yeah, you know. it's going to be a fun video, I think, when we're done with it. One of them commented I told him because he has a dog and everything. I'm like, you could let the dog go in the back seat, just put a cover on it or whatever, you know, drive these like they're your trucks, you know, use them, go to Lowe's, Home Depot, load the back up. One guy owns a farm. He had like bales of hay in the back of it and everything. And And he has a German Shepherd, an older German Shepherd. And he said, you know, his legs aren't, it's really old now. And he said he could climb into the Lightning, but he couldn't climb into Rivian.
Right.
So like, I mean, I think there's reasons why that Neil mode, some people would appreciate it, is what I'm saying.
Right. I mean, yeah, it's a handy option to have, I think. But all right. So one last little piece. So yesterday, Nissan prepares every year a bunch of a lot of automakers do this. Prepare a bunch of year like a bunch of cars to take to SEMA, and that's a big aftermarket manufacturer equipment sort of thing. Anyway, so they have some fence. They do up some special editions of cars, and one of the things they did actually for they did two electric things. Nissan did this year. They've got something they're calling the Aria Surf Wagon, which I don't know if we want to. I know Kyle will love this.
I mean, I don't know.
I mean, it's just an appearance package. It's just like,
they put this like Dom. That was Kyle saying, "No, you're wrong."
right. They put this like woody wrap on it, but then they put these like flashy wheels. So the wheels like look really awesome, but they just take over the whole kind of thing, you know. A little bit of balance of the color on the, with the surfboards on top, but yeah. But moving right along, Martin, to the other vehicle, not that one. There's another pickup truck. That's the Frontier, but there should be pickup truck coming.
That one? No.
Nope. It should be a little older. Oh, there,
that back one. Up there we go.
To your left. There we go. Yes. So this is the Nissan Sunny Leaf project. And man, I wish there was a way to get these things in like real life because I love this so much. My God.
It is the coolest freaking thing ever. I love this.
Did you see this already, Kyle?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course. This is like my background wallpaper on everything now.
Oh, is it?
I love this.
That's fast. So it's got like a 40 kilowatt hour battery from a Nissan Leaf inside. And I'm not really sure of all the details. I mean, they didn't really give a whole lot of details. Maybe you know what they are, Kyle. Do you know what's going on with the drivetrain?
Nope.
Yeah, I don't know if it's like a Nissan Leaf drivetrain. Did they put the motor on the...
I mean, it doesn't really matter because it's not going to go into production. But just look at how sick this thing looks. And fully electric. That's awesome.
Yeah, and it's not even I like usually like a king cab, but like just a regular, value, you know, two-seater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. It's a Nissan Leaf motor. They're using a manual transmission connected up to a Nissan Leaf motor. So.
Okay. Oh, they're keeping the manual in it.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So the motor's probably in the back then.
You would think. Probably.
I don't know. Kyle, these were rear-wheel drive cars, trucks?
Yes. So most likely the motor's up front and they just send it down the drive shaft is how a lot of these conversions are done. I don't know that to be true. I'm planning on going to SEMA and I want to check this out. So hopefully I'll see it there.
Yeah, maybe stick a camera up underneath the
Oh, I'm sure they'll pop the hood and talk about it.
Okay. Right on. Yeah, usually the motor will, in electric conversions, a lot of times they'll put the motor and just mount it right to the front of the transmission like that if it's a manual transmission. All right. So let's get on to what we've been driving this week. It is, yeah, we've got a good time here. So Kyle, you went with us last week, but I did want to mention, so the week before that you had you did a big full in-depth driving review, City Highway Canyon Performance Evaluated of the Lucid Air. I don't know, did you want to give us a quick 2-minute rundown of that?
Yeah, of the whole Lucid situation?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the driving is the car's highlight. That is where that car really shines. It's awesome. Lucid sent out a set of the 21-inch wheels. And so, you know, in full transparency, we tried to get a car. One of our viewers loaned us this car. The car had the 19-inch aero wheels on it, which I preferred because I wanted to do all the range testing and efficiency testing. And then Lucid sent out these wheels because they saw we had the car, and then all of a sudden, of course, it's like, oh, hey, what can we do to support you? And it was awesome. And they sent these out. And I was like, great. We need the good wheels for the performance stuff. This is the Grand Touring non-performance. And in the city, it's very good, very comfortable, very well controlled. The front motor is very loud because it's not an isolation mount. So the whole cabin acts as a reverb chamber at low speed. And it's like way louder than you would expect. Some people will love it if you like the EV motor noise. I think an S-Class buyer, probably a bit too loud. Where the car really shines, though, is sitting on the highway at speed. It's quiet. The suspension's tuned wonderfully for cruising. It's a really, really good highway long-distance driver. And up in the canyons, for its size, is surprisingly agile with incredible steering and, of course, really good drivetrain control logic, in my opinion. So I was very impressed with the driving of the Lucid Air. I think the big problem still, customers are not getting the lane centering function. This is so much after we had expected. So Peter, the owner of this car who loaned it to us, has become a friend. He's gotten two software updates now since I returned the car to him, both with the newest software version, both that still don't allow for lane centering. I guess Lucid put their biggest fans in this sort of pre-access beta program so they could post all about how good it is on Twitter. And that's what we've seen from them. So, you know, my impression at least was, hey, it's out in the public. It's actually wasn't. I believe we do have one Twitter follower, though, that does have it on a public car. So very weird software rollout, in my opinion. Not sure what their batches or wave strategy is. But either way, they obviously didn't want us to have the newest software on this car because we know they could have pushed lane centering to it because Tom's car had lane centering all those months ago. When he did the range test almost a year ago now. So if they wanted us to review the driver assistance, it could have happened. It didn't happen. That's totally fine. We'll borrow another car when it's production ready and we can do the real, you know, driver assistance testing and performance testing. This was the non-performance Lucid Air. And even though it has a traction control off button, it doesn't actually turn off. And so they said, you need to buy the performance for it to turn off. But I'm like, this one has the off button. It's just like,
right,
I really don't understand a lot of things about Lucid, and it's not to knock on the company at all. But it's just a very odd experience working with them compared to any other, you know, car we've reviewed where things just make sense. And so from my perspective, they built a really solid car. It drives, that's the car's highlight, drives really nice. And, yeah, honestly, if I just have to like go for a rip in the canyons and I had a Lucid Air in the driveway, I'd probably take the GT3 that's next to it because you probably have one of those if you have a Lucid Air. So I don't really know why it needs to go so fast and handle so well, but I'm glad it does.
Right. Dr. Two here in the comments has a Lucid himself, and he says he uses Highway Assist, works well, but it's still creepy to me, to him, which I kind of get to because I'm new to the Tesla autopilot thing myself, and it's taking me a while. I'm getting used to it now, and I'll use it in a lot more places than before.
But that doesn't really say the system's comparison to other systems. That's just saying lane centering in general is creepy, which that's a separate conversation. Right. I really want to see is, okay, well, I thought the adaptive cruise control was really nice on this. Very little phantom braking, really good control strategy for distance to cars. I thought they had that down pretty well, and good follow distance. So, yeah, I mean, I can't wait to test the full one when it comes. But I think it's worth mentioning, over a year since start of production, and the cars still feel very early days to me.
Right. Yeah, it feels like they do have some catching up to do. They opened up or broke ground possibly on the they're building a plant in the Middle East, and that, I believe that happened this week. Just
right. Well, they're Saudi backed, and so they're going to open that factory over there. Now, I'm not a good company analyst, but I will say on the software side, they hired Mike Bell, who used to, I believe, was a Steve Jobs report at Apple. And so, you know, fingers crossed, Mike is in there. It sounds like things are happening. They're readjusting their software. And, you know, my impression of the car and just from driving it, I don't know much about the inner workings of the company, nor do I want to know, is that the hardware is where all the effort was put. And then the software very much was like a secondary, like, oh, we need like navigation to work and all this stuff. But look at the efficiency and look at how great it handles. So to appeal to me, yeah, I appreciate all of that stuff. But as a well-rounded package, I get into my Model S right after and I'm like, oh, well, I can just, you know, do everything that I need to do right here. And it's got great driver assistance. And yeah, it'll get there. I'm curious how their four screen strategy will work versus the giant tablet in the center. you know, I'm not saying it won't work, but I know CarPlay has been something they've been, you know, wanting, people have been wanting, and CarPlay doesn't allow a split screen situation. Either way, yeah, it's a car that I have very mixed opinions on still.
Right, still. Right on. Okay, let's move along. You also, last week, we didn't talk about this. I know, and I know you, everyone's just like dying to know. So you bought the country's cheapest electric running electric vehicle, and you did it. You gave it a 70-mile-an-hour range test. We're talking about a 2012 Nissan Leaf?
Yep.
With some aerodynamic modifications to the rear end there?
Enhancements.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So you took it, did the your 70-mile-an-hour range test. So how did it do?
I actually don't remember. It was okay. Good. I think we hit 50 miles right on the nose. That's all you need. I mean, for me,
on the highway, 70 miles an hour.
Yeah, it's 70 miles an hour. Now, around the city, I think I could squeeze 80, 85 miles out of this thing.
I bet you could.
For $3,000 or $3,700. Like, that's, you know, all in by the time you register it, pay taxes, you're in for just over $4,000. So let's just call it a $4,000 car, which is significantly less than an option on a Tesla, you know, for the full self-driving option. You get an entire spare vehicle to cruise around the city in. And I love this thing.
Okay. Well,
Okay.
But it can only charge on CHAdeMO at this point, right? You can't charge on the J1772.
Right. And it's actually happening to a lot of early Leafs where the onboard chargers are failing. So it's actually kind of nice that we have this because we're going to do a onboard charger, either replacement or fix once we figure out what the issue is. There's two possible issues with it.
Cool. Because, I mean, that would be a non-starter for a lot of people. With such short range, needing to charge it on a CHAdeMO station is incredibly difficult. You know, besides with the short range, just getting to the CHAdeMO station back, you're going to use a quarter of your range. If this was able to charge at home for the price that you got it for, that would be stupid, ridiculously great. You know what I mean?
Because I don't think the price was affected because of the non-charging on AC thing. I don't think the owner really realized how big of a impact that was. It was mostly because of the crash history on the car. Impact.
Yeah. Well, I mean, whether the owner realized it or not, I bet you that's part of the reason why somebody didn't snatch it up before you. When they realized, I can't charge this at home.
Yeah, so I saw it pop up and I pounced on it. So there was no opportunity for anyone else. Tom, this is the most desirable car, okay? Don't be saying my Leaf people don't want this thing, because this thing is mint. No, but seriously, you're right. It's not practical for some people as their only vehicle, especially relying on CHAdeMO stations.
Yeah.
Well, that is why we're going to fix it.
That video that you make on that, I think, should be very good and educational for people because, as you said, other people are experiencing the same problem. So show them how to remedy it, you know?
Yeah, that'd be great. I'd be interested in watching that. I'd watch that, definitely. I like watching the mechanic, EV TV back in the day with Jack and... you know, just getting into details of tearing the hubs off of like old Volkswagen stuff. All the, you know, lots of little neat things that you never would know unless you see some like detailed video of it. So, but moving along. So this week, there's Blue with you, looking good, sitting up. So this week you have the Rivian R1S, Kyle, and it arrived, and you did a little question answer session with Alyssa. In there, and I believe that she likes it. Did she order one yet?
Or did you order? We've had one on order for her for some time now.
Oh, okay. But she got to drive it now and to see if she likes it. And what was the verdict?
Yeah, I actually don't think she's driven it yet, to be honest. Really? So she'll drive it at some point. She's going to be, you know, just like we did when we had the R1T test truck, you know, earlier this year. We have a series of videos planned. She's going to be seeing how the dogs fit inside, how it works with her friends who are moms, who are parents, you know, putting car seats in the back, using it for things. We actually reached out to a ton of Rivian owners and said, or reservation holders for this as well, what do you want to see? And so what I'm going to do today is a efficiency test at 60, 70, and 80 miles an hour, looking at those differences. I'm going to be doing the range test, but I'm going to swap on the aero wheels for the range test for that, just to give it the best chance. We'll probably take it to the track because that's very important for people to know how fast it is to clock lap times in their family SUV. We're going to do some off-roading with it, some camping. We have so much to do with this thing, really. But honestly, Getting out of my R1T and having it next to the R1S now, they're not all that different. Obviously, B-pillar forwards, they're identical. So just cruising down the highway, there's right. there's almost no difference. Okay. Where the R1S shines, though, is in the driving and handling characteristics. And Tom pointed it out when he went on their first drive event on the East Coast, somewhere in New York. You know, I took this up into the canyons yesterday, just kind of shake it down for myself. And so much more fun, so much more eager to rotate and get into a corner. And I'm on the all-terrain tires here, and this thing's wanting to dance, and I'm sliding it around, and I'm like, this is like a rally car, but I've got seven seats in it, and it's a huge battery underneath me. It was really cool. Now, I still think the harder you drive Rivians, the more the four-motor system idea starts to fall apart, because every time I come out of a corner, it's just spinning inside wheels with the outside motors maxed out. And so I'd love, again, a mechanical locking differential, all of these things. But I will say, as an owner of the R1T, I don't drive it hard. I drive it like a grandpa. I put it in squishy comfort mode, and I just cruise around, and then it's not really an issue at all. So, yeah, truly impressed with the R1S. I think the T rides a little bit better. That longer wheelbase smooths right. out some of the stuff. The R1S has more body motion, just in the way that it hits bumps, and you're definitely getting moved around a little bit more in R1S than R1T.
Right. That's all I'll do with the wheelbase length, I guess.
It's a huge difference in wheelbase length. And so right. I think what will really show that is, of course, I posted a picture on Twitter yesterday of them side by side, and you'll really see that massive difference. But also, just after this podcast, we're going to go up into the mountains and do our hill climb challenge with the T and the S. And I think that's where you're really going to see the benefits of that R1S short wheelbase not bottoming out, because I know my truck's just going to be skidding on the battery pack to complete this.
Okay. Right on.
Doc Tattoo is asking where's the hatch. Kyle actually put his hand over where there's a plastic cover that covers the hitch for aerodynamics, and that pops off, and the hitch is right under there. It does have a hitch,
but it can only tow, I think, 7,000 pounds versus R1T 11,000. So what we're going to do is max out the R1S and then tow that same load with the T and see if it tows any differently or why. I guess Rivian made their official responses. They made the engineering decision to not put the high strength rear subframe in it or something like that. I have it. They emailed me because I asked them. But yeah, basically it's a different rear end structure.
Okay. And that's why that's kind of odd. They would do that. I don't know.
Why not? I don't know really what the why of it, but
I guess save money. It would be,
I mean, I can get you their official response just so I don't mess it up. Tow rating is dependent on the rear tow structure. We made the engineering decision to increase the capacity of the R1T, but didn't carry the increased weight of that structure into the R1S. Oh. So it's a weight issue, I guess.
So there's a weight compromise involved there too. Mm-hmm. But I bet there's a cost compromise involved as well, just
sure.
because everything, there's costs involved with everything.
Yeah, and complication, if you can reuse a part on the production line, shouldn't that be the way to do it? I don't know. I'm not a production expert, but I will right. say that's at least their official response as okay. to why it doesn't tow as heavy as the T.
And Buddy points out that thing is standing high.
I put it maxed out. I think it goes higher than R1T.
Oh, really? Okay, because yeah. it looks really high. I assume that's what you had done. It was like it's like on stilts.
Yeah, I thought it looked cool like that because it's on the off-road tires. If you get the sport wheels on R1S, lowest suspension, slam it.
Right. With that Neil mode.
Yep, well, Neil mode's the same as lowest in the screen.
Okay. Right on. So anything else about the R1S you want to tell us?
Oh, there's really not much to talk about. It's the same thing as T, but a little bit more agile, more room inside. Alyssa's right. over the moon about it. She really right. wants one. And right. so we really love it. Obviously we have a T, my favorite vehicle I've ever owned. The S is not much different.
So you drove, I mean, so Alyssa didn't drive it, but she did. I remember now the first thing she did, I guess she folded down the back seats and everything to check out the room for the dogs. So that was like, that was it. She was sold.
Yeah. She wants air vents in second and third row and okay. lots of space for the dogs and a right. dog mode. So when she walks away from the car, the climate stays on.
Yeah.
This does all of that.
Sweet. Awesome. All right. So let's move on. Tom, You reviewed a new Charger this week. I just wanted to give you a chance to give us a really quick rundown on it. The Emporia 40-amp smart EV charger.
Yeah. So now that the garage is done, I started up the charger reviews again. I haven't done them for a few months because we were doing the whole renovation here and electrical upgrade, which, by the way, I finally got all the permits. Right now, I'm just running on my old electric. I haven't done the full 400 amp upgrade yet. So the Ford charge station Pro you see behind me, that's not connected yet. It's just hanging on the wall. We're going to be doing the full upgrade in about 2 weeks. The electrical upgrade, 400 amp service, the house, and Ford's intelligent backup power with the bidirectional charging for the Lightning, and all that's coming in about 2 or 3 weeks. I forget. The end of November is when we have the install date. My utility has to install a new transformer in front of my house. It's a really big and really expensive job, but they're making me pay for it because they're like, this is unnecessary, right? And nobody else needs this but you, so you're gonna pay. But any event, yeah, I did the review of the Emporia 48 amp charger. Now it comes out of the box as a 40 amp unit because it has a NEMA 1450 plug. But you can remove the plug and directly hardwire it. And when you do that, you can set it through the app to deliver the full 48 amps. It's a really good unit, scored really well. It has a lot of interesting features. One of them is Emporia has a whole host of energy saving and monitoring devices that can work, an entire ecosystem that can work in conjunction with this. And if you get their energy monitoring system, you can actually have this set, and if you have solar at your house, so that it only charges your EV with excess solar generation.
Oh, neat.
So you could say, you know, your EV is only on solar electric. Now, I have solar electric at my house. To me, that's not a big deal because if I'm feeding the grid for a while when my system's producing more energy than what my house is using, and then I come in later and I plug in and now I'm pulling energy from the grid, to me it's a wash. I don't have to feel like those electrons have to go from the panels into my battery. As long as I'm producing them, you know, if my neighbor's using them for a little while, that's fine by me. And, you know, so to me, that wasn't that big of a deal. But some people think it's really cool. And, you know, that's fine. Overall, it scored really well. I scored it a 4.6 stars out of 5 overall. One of the highest rated stations I've had. It's very well priced, really well. When this thing came to market, it was only $399, ooh, which was the least expensive 40 amp unit that you could get. Now I'm going to talk about what's going on in the video here in a second. Okay. But they have increased the price to $499 because of supply chain problems lately. All the inflation, the cost of their materials have gone up. But I did talk to Emporia about this, and they said, look, if things settle down, we're hoping to be able to back out of that price a little bit, maybe lower it a little bit, because their goal is to have this be like the most affordable 48 amp smart charger available on the market. Now, I'm really focusing here on the connector, because one of the things that really bothered me about this unit, it's a great unit altogether, is the connector and the connector holster. As you can see over here, if I grab the connector to remove it, I can't pull it off the wall. You have to actually lift it up and lift it over like this. I don't like that. I want to be able to grab the connector and put it and plug in my car. It's really ergonomically a huge miss. And also the fact that it's pointing up all the time. I don't like when connectors are pointing up in the air like that, because now you have to put that rubber cap on it. A lot of these are mounted outside. Can you imagine if you forgot to put the rubber cap on it, it started raining, the connector would fill with water. You'd come out, you'd have to dump the water out. And, you know, it's just it's a very poor design, the connector holster, and it lost a lot of points in my rating because of that. You know, the good thing is Emporia reached out to me, and they even tweeted, Like, you know, we hear you loud and clear. We're looking on improving our product based on your review. So I almost think that they're going to do something. I mean, it'd be really simple.
Yeah, they could take it and do this. Add different holster designs.
They could just supply something like this, a remote connector holster. Sure. This is Wallbox's remote connector holster. And it just plugs in and have this thing mounted on the wall next to it. Now you see the whole end of the connector is protected from rain, from dust. Even if this thing's mounted inside in your garage, if you're like me, you cut wood, you work inside your garage, those particles become airborne. They're going to settle into this connector. And over the years of, you know, like having dirt and dust and moisture in there, when you plug in, you know, it's going to foul these pins. And it's just an unnecessary... thing, you know, but by now these charging companies should know that the connector needs to be protected all the time, and they shouldn't make it hard for you to protect it. So other than that, it's really good. That's me showing the app. You can adjust the amperage inside the app. You can scale it all the way down to only 20 amps or 15 amps if you want. It comes out of the box, as I said, set at 40 amps because it's a plug-in unit. You have to go in and change it if you want. I'm not a huge fan of the app-based changing of amperage because you can make a mistake. And I've had people do that. And like I said, this comes out of the box as a 40 amp unit. And I've had people respond to me and say, you know, during setting it up, I set it to 48 amps by mistake and I overdrew my circuit. I prefer when the units have dip switches inside the units because I don't want the end user playing with the amperage. And I know that a lot of people don't agree with me on that. User says, I want to have control if I want to dial it down. That's great, but I think there should be a dip switch inside that sets the limit that you can, so you can't overdraw a circuit. Then if you want to dial it down further to charge slower, that's great, but there should be something inside. So it lost a point in my ratings on that. I mean, I get into the weeds with all these little minutiae about the chargers, and I think that's why people like my videos on them, because I really dive into all the tiny little aspects of it. But it's a pretty good unit. The cable did fairly well in my deep freeze test. The connector drop test, it passed. So, I mean, it's a recommended unit for me. I think Emporia did a really good job with it.
Sweet. And you also went to Texas this week to check out the new Wallbox manufacturing facility down there, a big factory. It looks pretty nice.
Yeah. So Wallbox invited me out to Arlington, Texas, and they just had their grand opening. It was a huge event. I mean, the mayor of the city spoke. I mean, there's you know, a couple hundred people there. Okay. They're opening up a 130,000 square foot facility to manufacture all the chargers that are going to be used in North America here, instead of currently they're being imported from, you know, they have factories around the country. Their main headquarters is in Barcelona. Now they're making all the North American products here, which is the Pulsar Plus, which I've reviewed. They have a 40 amp, 48 amp unit. Great unit. Again, another one of my top rated units. They're going to be coming out with the Quasar 2, which is the bi-directional unit. Now they've been going to be coming out with this for a long time, but at CES in 2020, I interviewed Doug Alfaro, the general manager of Wallbox, and he was going to get me one of the Pulsar, the first Quasar, and it just never materialized. They never brought it to the U.S. They did launch it in Europe. It's a bi-directional unit. It's a DC charger, so it circumvents the onboard inverter, you know, goes right to the battery pack. But it was only, I don't know if it was 9.6 kilowatts or 7.6. It was a low powered unit. This new one's 11.5 kilowatt, and it's CCS only. The previous one was CHAdeMO only. The company's made a decision to abandon CHAdeMO. They're done with it. They're not going to put it on any of their DC fast chargers that they're making now, or the Quasar 2, which is going to be the bidirectional charger that you can purchase for your home. They're going to get me one of those as soon as it's available, which I think is going to be in a few months. I couldn't talk to them. They didn't really want to talk about it at this event because it's not ready yet. I think they're going to have me back to the factory to do a demonstration when it is ready in a few months. But they also showed for the first time their new Hypernova. They make a DC fast charger called the Supernova. It's in use in Europe. They don't have any of them in North America yet. That one maxes out at 150 kilowatt. It's a standalone DC fast charger. It has the power modules built into it. Okay. The Hypernova now delivers up to 400 kilowatt. And okay. It has the exterior cabinets and it power shares. It has two cables that both of them could be used at the same time. And it will intelligently share power between vehicles. Looks like it's a good unit. It's not 100% done yet. There were some things on it that I didn't like that I pointed out to the engineers and they smiled and said, yeah, this is still like a beta unit. You hit the nail on the head. That's not going to make it to production. For instance, the connector holster was like kind of a thin plastic. And I told the guys, when nobody else was present, I didn't want to embarrass them. I said, you can't bring this to market with that because that's going to break. You know, the connector holster, it's plastic. The CCS connector is heavy. And I said, get this in the winter when it's cold out and the plastic gets brittle and somebody grabs it and pulls it. I said, they're going to pull the connector off the ground. They said, yeah, we know. We already have a redesign for that. But overall, it seemed like it was a good unit. It has a nice, clear, bright a touch screen, and they said that they put a lot of time and effort into making sure it was like glare resistant and will hold up over time and won't fade. And I mean, everything fades when sun, if the sun just beats on it forever. The sun, you can't beat the sun, it's eventually gonna damages everything. But they appeared to put a lot of time and effort into making sure that it was bright and clear. I think it's a good unit, and we're gonna see they're gonna make that at this factory also. Currently, the factory's open now, and they're at a production rate of 250,000 Pulsar Pluses per year. Huge facility. They actually had something like 15,000 Pulsar Pluses made and in boxes on racks that they showed us. They're selling a lot of the Pulsar Pluses right now. It's one of the most popular level two units out there. But this facility will, right now they're at a 250,000 a year run rate. By 2030, they're going to be making more than 1 million units, and they're going to have 700 employees, which is really good for local economy. One of the things that was cool about it was they walked us through the whole chain where they were building them, and all the employees were there putting the cables on, clamping all the connections down to the proper, torquing them to the right, strength and everything. I have video of it. I'm going to have a video coming out pretty soon on that. And all of their tech and everything is designed in-house. They don't outsource. They everything. The entire chain of that, they even make their own components. And I thought that was pretty interesting. And they said they really control their whole supply chain, which is pretty cool.
Right on. Awesome. So last week's show, we finished off. And then like a little while later, Martin sent this little message over Teams. So he gets off, nothing to do, had a great show last week. And then boom, he buys a car. Like, Martin, what's going on, dude? What's going on?
I got no driving impressions because I haven't driven it yet, but okay. Straight after the show last week. No, it wasn't straight after the show. I think the family were in bed, I think. I stumbled across Kyle's video from last November on Out of Spec Reviews where he drove the updated Hyundai Kona. Did a canyon run in that, and it's a great video. And it just reminded me how good the Hyundai Kona is. And we had one before for 3 months on loan in Ultimate Trim. And I thought, I really miss that vehicle. It was so good for family life. But at the time, 2-3 years ago, our little fella was still a baby. And it's funny, the smaller children are, the bigger their stuff. So his baby seat was huge. And the Kona struggles with rear leg room. And so it was just too small for us. And so it didn't suit us then. Well, now he's starting school. He's four and he's about to start school. And now he just sits in a little booster seat is the legal thing we have here that kind of comes up. And anyway, and I thought that would suit us. And so I'm going to go and send an invoice to Kyle for £29,000 because that's what he owes me for making me buy a Kona. So I'll email that over in a minute.
It's a great choice. I love it. And you got the new refresh one, right?
Yeah, so it's on 1,000 miles. Our version of Carvana, there's a couple really. One of them is called Kazoo, and it's on 1,000 miles and is basically a new car. Now, it was on for 29,000, new they're 30 and a half, if you can get a deal from a dealer. So a small discount on buying a brand new one. It's effectively brand new. I mean, the tires look new. There's no, I've been over the paintwork. It's fine. Goodness knows why they had a used one, had one owner, a used one for 1,000 miles. Something's happened there, but hey, the car came on the market. It wasn't dirt cheap, but I thought it wasn't expensive. And I've got a buddy who actually runs a franchise Hyundai dealer. And so I messaged him a few weeks ago to say, oh, I'd like one. What's the waiting time? There's a long waiting time on brand new ones. And this one got delivered within 2 days to my driveway. So it turned up Wednesday. And I'm ashamed to say, with being super busy and having a family, it has sat in the driveway. And I haven't even taken it on that first kind of, oh, I'll whip round the block. The keys are on the side. I'll use it this weekend, which means we now have to sell the mighty, mighty MG, which has done us well for a year. But look, as Carl says, the Kona is really good for a, you know, we're a small family. We carry less stuff with us these days. We went small battery, actually. And, okay. We just don't need 300 miles. I mean, you want it. You always want the range, right? You always want it, but we don't need it. But yeah, absolutely spec'd out really well. There's an optional heat pump, I think, on the spec list here in UK, at least. I don't think it came with that. It hasn't got that. I don't need it. But apart from that, love, love, love the grey paintwork. And yeah, basically, a new car that turned up, and we're really delighted with. But I can't give you driving impressions because...
Next week.
But yeah, my wife and I, they say opposites attract, but we are identical in that we take a long time to make a decision. And that's like, what should we have for dinner tonight? Well, I like Chinese. Do you want Indian? I like Thai. And it's like, it's so rare that the next morning, I said to her, can we buy this car? She was like, oh, I love the color. Yeah, let's buy it. And that's it. And these online, I'd never used Cazoo before. But yeah, it's a case of put your credit card details, your bank details in. It spat back my bank card and said, declined. We don't work with that bank or whatever. So do a bank transfer. So you send the money. And if you don't like it within 7 days or 250 miles or 7 days, they'll just come and get it. And so I thought, well, there's no risk. And I've always bought cars from dealers or friends who sell cars and things like that. Or auctions in the past, actually. I like buying cars from auctions. Right. But first time we'd used it, I'd recommend it. To this point, I've had a great experience. Very, very high tech. Lots of communication, lots of texts and emails and things of your car is here, little GPS tracker, it's coming, it's half an hour away. It's on the turned up on a nice, shiny, covered truck, where it's the only, it's the kind of truck that fits one car, like a personal car carrier, turned up, was detailed beautifully. And I've had a great experience using that so far, but I take no responsibility for buying it. It's all Kyle's fault.
All right.
So let me get this straight. Since Dom has talked about buying a Bolt,
yes!
Martin has bought a Kona. I've bought two electric trucks. Kyle, what are you up to now? At least three vehicles
since he bought that.
Four new vehicles since Dom.
Oh, and there's more that you don't even know about.
Dom, you gotta do it. I mean,
you're penny pinching a couple grand over a couple of months. Just go buy the damn thing. You'll forget about it.
Well, so the latest on the my saga. Oh my God. So last week. Last Saturday, I was headed to Valdosta, Georgia to meet the Carvana truck. I had the Sparky V towed to Valdosta, Georgia. It's like at the edge of its range, 75 miles. So $325 for a flatbed tow out there. And the tow truck driver took a key and he put it under the hood of the car, actually, so no one could get it and stuff. So Saturday morning, I get up nice and early. I get all my documents together. I've got the title and everything. So I drive to Valdosta, Georgia. It's like a nice hour and a half in Kyle's Tesla Model 3 Performance, which I'm loving so much. Oh my God, I love that thing. So I get there. I pull up to it. I see it in the parking lot. They've dropped it off in the Walmart parking lot, which is where I'm supposed to meet the Carvana person. They come out of Atlanta. And they come down there pretty much on the daily. And so I pull up to it and I lean over to grab the key, which is on the pile of papers. And it was at that moment that I knew that I messed up and somehow left my key at home to my car. So now I'm in Valdosta, Georgia, with this person coming down from Atlanta to meet me with her truck, and I have no way to get into my car. I'm in panic mode. Oh my God. I almost had my nephew try to run out, you know, run out to home, pick up my key and run it like the hour and a half, but I couldn't get them to stay. So I had to reschedule the appointment. So they didn't cancel my deal. So I'm still, you know, set up to the same kind of deal. But then, so I had to drive back to Valdosta the next day. And so I'm worried about my car now, sitting in the Walmart parking lot all by its own, you know. So I'm worried about it getting towed and all that entails, and then showing up, you know, the next week to make the arrangement and there's no car there, or it's been damaged or something, whatever. So I go up the next day with a friend and we drive it to the Valdosta Regional Airport, which has free long-term parking, which is amazing. And it's not that far away. And so fingers crossed it is there tomorrow. They give me another appointment for tomorrow, like 4:30. And so I'm going to double check I have everything with me this time. I even remembered to bring screwdrivers to remove the license plate on it. And then I had to put the license plate back on it, actually, because oh my God. It's been a whole issue. Right.
Well, I honestly think you're making it an issue for yourself. This sounds like a pretty easy problem. We already found you a Bolt at MSRP for $26,000, brand new, right down the street in Alabama. You just got to drive over there, pick it up. I think as soon as the tax credit comes back up, you'll see the prices of Bolt go up proportionally.
Yeah,
so what right. I would recommend is at the last week of December, lock in a price with that dealer and say, hey, I'm going to put a, you know, give you a $2,000 deposit. Please don't sell this at end of month, you know, whatever, make it worth their while, lock in that price and go for 2023. The dealer might still back out on you because January 1 rolls around, GM will get their new pricing and those Bolts might just be, you know, whatever cash on the hood they have might just evaporate. And they might be a lot more money.
Brad Jackson wants some of this Bolt action. He's asking which Alabama dealer.
We're not going to say because Dom needs the car.
Right. But my local dealer actually has an LT2, which is kind of nice. And I think it's at 32 after. It's 36, I think. But then they have like, is it $5,900? Well,
that's a
off?
Huge price jump from what you were talking about trying to get one at 20.
It is a lot. Yeah, it is a lot. But I was thinking maybe I can talk them down now because they're making. So
they're not going to sell it under sticker.
I don't know. They might.
No, they won't. No one will.
Well, I'm going to talk to the guy because it can't hurt to ask, right? All they can say is no.
They're not going to do it. Right. Especially when you're like, oh, I'm going to wait till next year.
Right.
They're going to be like, today, maybe.
Sure.
We need to start a GoFundMe, I think.
Get the
Inside EVs community. Everybody chips in $10 and it brings the price down to under the what Dom would save on the federal tax credit. So he could just buy it now.
Get it now. Just get it. Put it in your driveway. Do it now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Plus the snow's falling. I want my car back at some point because I got a lift it for snowmobile videos.
Right. Yes. Yeah. We need to make those arrangements to get that up there. It's the 28th now. So yeah, like pretty soon. Really soon.
Mid-October.
Are you going to drive it back, Dom?
Either me or what's his name? Justin. Not Justin.
Who are you talking about? Simon. Simon, Jordan.
Right. Okay. I don't know why I blanked on Jordan's name. But Jordan mentioned that he kind of wanted to come down and pick it up and drive it because he's got family between here and there.
What?
But I don't know if he has.
I'm not paying for Jordan's vacation to go pick up my drive it across the country so you don't have to.
I don't think
that's not a good use of our company resources.
Well, I mean, you're going to get a receipt for that, and he'll be like, that's an company expense.
Well, Jordan's on salary. I need to maximize his time. He can't be sitting in the car all week.
Well, he could be making videos at the same time.
No, because we have a backlog of motoring videos. We don't need any more.
Okay.
Just take it out of the 25 cents a mile you're charging Dom.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I'm not charging Dom.
Well, that makes it easier, though. So I guess within the next couple of weeks, I need to drive that back to you.
I know we're up at the end of the show, but I also just want to mention that we did a track day in our Model S plan. And not enough people are tracking these things, I think. And I think it was really interesting. So Model S Plaid, everyone thinks obviously really fast. We know that, but Model S is old, not the best shredder handling chassis. The brakes really suck out of the factory and it's very under tired. So we put on, you know, Martian wheels, 10 inch wide, I think 295 section tires, square front and rear, Michelin Pilot Sport 4S, which is a street tire, not an R compound tire. It's my daily driver tire. We put on Mountain Pass Performance front and rear, biggest brake kit they have. I'm a fan of steel brakes over carbon ceramic brakes for this application. Carbon ceramic brakes are great for fast street driving, but with track driving, when you really get them hot, the rotors will eventually dissipate. They lose weight and you'll burn up the discs. And then you're in for, you know, $5,000+ per rotor. No thanks. I'll go steel brakes and just, you know, replace them out. Way cheaper. And, you know, it still has half a steering wheel, which was a little bit of a worry getting out on track, but it actually turned out to be not that bad. We're still putting the round wheel on it, but we ran High Plains Raceway. The car pretty much stocked at a 157, 158, which is incredibly fast around that track for a stock out of the box car. You know, consistently over 160 miles an hour down the back straight every time. We got the motors turning a dark orange, but the car still performed amazingly from a powertrain standpoint. The Mountain Pass brakes, we of course did fluid as well. Really stood up to the challenge. Very impressed with the braking system. The overall balance of the car with a square setup is really nice, and track mode's perfect. It's actually like super drifty. We had to go like a 30-70 split, 70% rear, because the car was just wanting to go full drift mode, and I love that. So very tail happy, a little bit rowdy. It's heavy, so it's soft, so you feel the car moving and pitching and diving. But yeah, just a couple little suspension upgrades to go and a round wheel, and like, this thing has some potential. So actually really way more impressed than I thought I would be with the Plaid out on track. We're going to be doing a lot of track sessions next year with it, so a lot more to come.
Anthony Rinaldi is asking, when is that video hitting?
Didn't record a video. We, Alyssa and I, drove through the night to actually make it to this track day. Is when we were towing, I don't think we talked about it either, we towed 2,000 miles with our Rivian R1T. We towed a Lucid Air out to California, and then I bought a car and towed that back, just an old Lexus. And that was an interesting trip. Maybe we'll save it for next week's show, or we'll at least have the motoring video up. But we got to the track after not sleeping, and I was just like, I just want to drive around the track and not film a video. So it was just for fun.
Right on. Louis Diaz says Dom needs a life coach. Very true. I do.
Hey, I've tried to guide him on this car purchase. If it were up to me, he'd be driving the new Maybach S-Class, you know, 3 months ago.
Right. And starting to have my own YouTube channel to pay for it.
Honestly, that's the move. Like, you're doing enough stuff.
Right. That is the move. All right. So we should let y'all go because it's a beautiful day out there. And yeah, that's it. So that brings us to the end of our show. If you have any questions or comments, you can leave them on the Inside EVs forum podcast thread or on our YouTube or Twitch comment sections. If you like the show, please give us a thumbs up. If you're watching us on YouTube, good to see over 300 or so thumbs up last week. And you can find and follow our panelists on Twitter. Follow Tom Logney at Tomolog. That's with two M's. Martin Lee is at EV News Daily. Kyle Connor is at It's Kyle Connor. And I'm at Dominic_Y. Click subscribe. Tap that bell icon for notifications. And because we have a special episode coming up, so you don't want to miss that. I believe on Monday morning, a little surprise for y'all, a little midweek infrastructure. Yeah, and we'll see you all again next time. Ciao.